All right, I believe it's time for us to start our Bible study. If you can find your predetermined location, your spot there, and we'll settle in for our class this evening. We're going to be in chapter 34 in just a moment. We'll be picking up with a continued renewal of the covenant and the creation of the second set of stone tablets. Before we get into our study here, though, if you would bow your heads in prayer with me, we'll begin our class, as is our custom, with a prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this special time we have set aside to study together as a group. Help us to be not only attentive students, but also prepared to bring to the study a heart that is ready to glorify and honor you. Help us in all that we do to be humble servants, to set a good example in our speech and in our conduct, so that no matter where we may find us, the way in which we live mimics the desire of our heart. That is, that we are more like your Son every day. Please forgive us of our sins, and we ask this prayer in his name. Amen. All righty, we are again in Exodus chapter 34, looking at the follow-on events. Remember, we had moved from the rebellion of Israel and their desire to replicate the pagan worship of the nations around them. As we have repeatedly identified, it's the section where you get to learn, out came this cow, out came this golden calf. From there, there is the intercession of Moses, his very generous and merciful heart, that he is willing to stand before God and ask God forgiveness of them and for them for their sins. The next phase after that conversation takes place is the recreation of the covenant, both on the tablet side, and then we're going to pick up here in verse 10 in the actual stone tablets set to the side, if you will, and then moving forward. But before we do that, I wanted to highlight something that comes up in this section. There's a lot of this next phase, and that's in the probably, like, say, verses 7 and following, that have to do with the nature of God. Understanding who God is at times is a little bit of a mystery until we get to the New Testament. And let me say a couple reasons why that's the case. One of them is in the New Testament, it explicitly says that if you see the Christ, you can see the Father. And so by the time we get to that point, Jesus serves as a visual representation of the character and person of God. And until then, God has a much more distant place in the presence of his followers. He's moved himself out of the camp at this point here in this chapter. When you look at the day-to-day life of an average Israelite under the kingdom of David, the kingdom of Solomon, even the kingdom of Saul, God at times was viewed through the lens of being a little bit afar off by each step. They might have seen God in the grandness of his creation, but they didn't have a very personal connection to him. It was often, unfortunately, through the priests, through the Levites, through the temple. And even then, their understanding of the law would rise and fall on the basis of those men. If they were very zealous leaders, then they made sure that the physical Israel knew about God. If they were lazy, or greedy, then they made sure they didn't know about God, so they either get the money or the power. And that's how those kingdoms rose and fell. And if you remember, one of the prophets has that great phrase, "My people are destroyed for what? A lack of knowledge." And so that's a struggle of the specifics of the law. But think about this. For the Old Testament believer, that's before the cross, understanding whom God is kind of like what we're doing right now. They have to go back, read through the Pentateuch, the Old Testament law, read through the prophets, and try to gather a picture of whom God is. What I want to do right now, though, is just to show some of the things in just these few chapters that are going to be reiterated in the covenant that kind of help us see who God is. So using just Genesis to begin with, in Genesis chapter 2, we learn that God is just. His standard is included in His nature. But He's also merciful. Because right after, you know, the one rule, if you will, that Adam and Eve had to live by, they broke. And the concept, it's like, you tend the garden, this whole space is yours, but just don't eat of the tree of the fruit of knowledge. Don't do that. God turns around and is merciful to them. He gives them protection. He makes clothes for them that are suitable to cover and suitable to protect. He gave them a place to move to and move from. He gave them knowledge of their next steps. He still continued to care for them. So He's a merciful God. We also learn about His emotions in Genesis chapter 6, that He can be grieved. That's not just a Jesus thing, if you will, where we say Jesus wept or His heart was torn asunder. Well, God grieved in Genesis 6, verses 5 and 6. He also makes choices that we would say are sovereign or royal, in that He makes a choice as a ruler. In this case, in the case of Noah and the flood, He made a decision by royal or noble fiat. That is, He's God, He gets to decide how. He decided how to save Noah and his family. We sometimes will say He could have done it any other way, and He could have. He had all the ability to do it in any number of different ways, but this one was chosen because there are reasons why, and those were His reasons. He has the capacity of omniscience and foreknowledge. He's able to know what's going on and to look to the future and see what will go on. He's omnipotent. And He has all power. He spoke the world into existence, Genesis 1:6. He is consistent or everlasting. And then we move to Exodus, is where we are right now. It reaffirms that to us. And this is the whole idea of Exodus. Well, He even identifies Himself to Moses as, "I am that I am." So that's kind of a little bit of quick background, if you will, just to tie together. When they renew a covenant with God, this God of the Old Testament, this God of Israel, the God of creation, is different than the gods they were surrounded with. We're not as familiar with Mesopotamian gods and Egyptian gods as we are with, say, Roman gods. I don't know about y'all, but when I was in high school and in some of my college classes, a lot more emphasis is placed on the Roman and Greek gods than the Egyptians and Mesopotamian gods. Is that the same case for you guys? If you remember. Which I struggle to remember sometimes too. So sometimes we're not familiar with what the contrast was. I'll tell you on a quick survey. All of the infighting and family-based mythological conversations you have taking place between the Greek and the Roman gods, which are actually the same thing, different names for the same people, is essentially the same kind of turf wars that take place in the Egyptian gods and the Mesopotamian gods. And if you think about them in a turf war context and a family fight context, that's pretty much every man-made god of the major areas of the region. A lot of the earlier ones were also more often connected to fertility as well, but they still had turf, things that were mostly important for them. You can think about the Greek and the Roman gods. You have that god of war. the god of whatever, and they fight against, the god of messengers or this and that. They fight for their turf, and they argue and complain about the people that they are leading. Well, all of the gods of the Egyptians and the Mesopotamian region, the crescent there, were the same concept. God of creation, the one true God, was different than that. One is that he's monotheistic, just one of them. This is the God. And they're all it's consistent unity. When we talk about one God, we're talking about the unity of concept and purpose. It's not that Jesus is not God and the Spirit is not God. It's that they're always unified. That's hugely different than any other religions in that area. That makes this covenant they're making with this God that much different too. Because all the nation states, all the little cities, all the various religious tribes of this area, they were already adhered to their gods. They had the equivalent of a covenant, if you will. we even see that in some of the biblical accounts where the prophets will go up against a false god, a Baal in particular. Oh, maybe he is indisposed. Maybe he doesn't care about you anymore. Is one of those particular instances. And so understanding the person whom they're connecting with in the covenant is really important for us as we start forward looking to the actual text of the covenant. Let's do that really for our benefit right now. So let's pick up chapter 34, and we're going to read right now just verses 10 through 16. let's see here. Bobby, do you want to read that for us, 10 through 16? Right, and a couple of things are important with the language that's used here. Remember on the back end of what had just taken place with this pagan worship, including the immorality that would be included. When the text here uses the term, I think the King James used go whoring, the other ones have similar harlotry type phrases. The immorality isn't of a physical concern per se. What's being discussed here is the selling of themselves. That's the forceful emphasis there. And so you think about what that would imply when it's coming to, you'll have no other gods before me. That's part of the covenant, the expectation. Don't sell yourself off. And particularly don't sell your sons and your daughters off to a false god. There's some context that's going to help us see the value of it, even in this immediate section right here, when he reminds them, don't make covenants with these nations around them. And here's the context for it. If we go back and think through Genesis, when we were talking about the patriarchs before captivity, how did they solve, how the nations tend to want to solve problems with one family group and another? Intermarrying. That's how they would do it, even all the way up into the monarchies. Oh, well, we can't be at war anymore because my daughter married your son and our nations are now forever intertwined. And that happened all the way up until even recent history. And those family groups are fairly well inbred because of those choices they would make. God here tells them not to do that. In the past, they avoided it for different reasons, per se. Here, it's not only don't intermingle broadly, it's don't do it at all. Don't make these covenants. Any covenant that would be included in this context would be a marital-based one. And he's saying, don't sell your kids off. Don't sell your daughters off. Don't sell your sons off. It's not going to actually provide the peace that they want. Further, context will show us that they, when they did make covenants with these nations that were already in there, you remember one time they got tricked? They remember the story of them being deceived by a group that pretended to be travelers from afar? They had to keep the covenant, but it cost them. It cost them on a reputation side. It certainly impacted their spiritual side. But when you see the conquest that finally takes place a few generations from Egypt to then, after they've raised a new, whole new generation in the wilderness, do they need a covenant with any of those nations to be successful? Not at all. Do they need a mighty armor, you know, a mighty army to get past any of those places? When you think about them marching around a city, it's not about the potential of the sound waves to weaken the walls. Not about any of those things. It's not even about the visual impact of that. It's that they did what God said. When it comes down to it as a bottom line, they're doing what God said. When he narrows the group on the basis of how they get a drink of water, it's to identify a small segment, because that's all he needs. He didn't even need that. So this whole covenant reminder of their covenant versus the other covenants around it matches that big context of helping them realize if they trust in this kind of God, a God who is so much different than anything they're around, is genuine and true, they're not going to need those covenants. They're not going to need any of that. All they have to do is build faith in who he is. And as we've reminded ourselves, we'll do this again right here, this is new to a lot of them. This is a new relationship they're entering into. But it's different now because it's begun to be tested. The first time you see a new relationship starting, a friendship, a work relationship, a new business starts up, everybody's all excited, right? Nervous and oh, this is going to be great. Oh, this is going to be amazing. And then you hit your first rough patch. Your first day where you're not getting as many sales. The first argument about what you're going to do, who you are, what you're going to be. Well, Israel and God have already been through those first growing pains of a connection to one another. And you're seeing the strength of God next to the weakness at times of Israel. God is steady. He's consistent. And they're at times pretty fickle. That also ties into the language that's used here. Because the same terminology, that though it's not so much on the immorality side, it certainly ties into the latter uses of the same concept when he talks about them basically being spiritual adulterers and chasing after a foreign god as a breaking of the relationship that they had, in essence, a marriage, a covenant. Any quick questions or long questions or thoughts on that first section there? Mike?
Yeah, I'm not simple, there are a lot of things I can think of for God's sake, whether it's in work or family or hobby. I always make sure I remember that.
I thought I heard somebody else pop up too. I remember a phase in life where the jealous boyfriend was something you were never supposed to be, right? You guys remember that phase in your life? I'm talking to the guys. And did you see other dudes and you act to him and he's like, oh, there he is. He's being the jealous boyfriend. It's not going to go well for him. There's some more attributes to God than just his jealousy. But make no bones about it. God cares where you're spending your time. Because the problem with a jealous boyfriend, and here's the real thing, is the jealous boyfriend is making up things to be worried about. That's a person who is, well, where is she? She's not with me. So clearly she's doing something bad. God knows where we are. Jealous girlfriends exist too, but I have no personal experience in that area, so I can't speak to it. But God knows where we are. He knows where our heart is. And so when jealousness is talked in the sense of God, it has nothing to do with improperness or invasiveness or overbearing and all those things that are negative aspects on the earthly side. God knows our heart already. Before we made a decision, He knows that. And He knows when we go beyond, when our decision is made and then our actions step over the line. And so understanding that sense of jealousy there, I think, is super important. And Mike's right, you know, it is also a struggle to make those choices, you know, to determine, am I making the right value judgment? Is my opinion really solid on what's right for me to do? It's okay to back off for a moment and say, let me ask that question again before I act. It's okay. Okay, so to clarify, when you say optics, you're talking about how it looks. Okay, make sure I understand, because not everyone uses that word the same way. That was for my benefit, not for anybody else's. So it does matter how it looks. It always matters how it looks. And here's how I can tell you this. If you see someone doing good, and you see them doing good, does it matter how it looks? It's not you, it's them. Does it matter how it looks? Yeah. And if you see someone doing bad, does it matter how it looks? Yeah. Okay, so if we can understand it over there and over here, and if what we're doing, no matter what our motivation is, looks bad, then rethink your process. Stop for a second and think. It may look bad because of association, because you're doing something that's okay. Not morally good, not morally bad, it's all right, but you're doing it in a place that's full of bad things. Rethink your motivation. Maybe you're a doctor and you have to be there. Maybe you're a nurse and you have to be there. Maybe you're a police officer and you came up on something awful. Nothing you can do about it. You know, as a preacher sometimes and helping with elders over the years, I've had to be in some bad places. I'll just tell you one quick one. Going to someone's home, the husband in the home had become addicted to pornography. And we had to get all the pornography, back in that day it was not digital, it was all physical goods, out of the house. Think I wanted to be there? No. Not at all. Do you think the elders and the elder preacher that was there with me, wanted to be there? Not at all. Did we need to be there? You want to see a red-faced young man pulling a box out of the house and hoping no one sees him? I'm already red-faced to begin with. I guarantee you I was looking like Moses coming out of the building because it was, I didn't even look what was in there. I just knew it was in there. And it was a plain box. But I knew that everybody else knew what was in the box. Okay, so that's the case. The same thing's true today about pretty much understanding how people are. Because our influence matters. Our goal is to make sure, and this is a hint to our Sunday sermon, we'll just throw that out there, that when we encourage and influence someone, we're not the boat anchor that holds them down. We're not the speed bump, the rock of offense. Our job is to pull them up, and our influence in that way matters. So some wisdom can be used in making choices on simple things of, you know, where you find your fun, where you find your hobbies. We usually have choices in that area. And you can go across the board. You can pick it in where you eat, where you work, where you go for vacations. You know, across the board, you can make those value judgments. They're not always easy. And just because a place is branded as a family atmosphere doesn't mean it's the right one for the family of God. You know, just because there may be other factors in play. Is that sensible enough? I would at least explain my answer to it, where I was coming from, Joe. Right. I'll also say that this is a good point also. When you have a question like that, ask somebody for advice if you really want to get a good direction. Especially if you know they'll challenge you and make you think about what you're going to be doing. It's perfectly okay to ask someone a question and have them, and you know they're not going to like your question, and you know they're going to tell you something different than what you want to hear. I'll tell you, that's actually a good thing. Why not be challenged? Especially in those areas of value judgment. If you do it well, you're both stronger afterwards. We need that in our lives. We don't need an echo chamber where everything's always the same, the same, the same. All right. Next section of the text is a continuance of a type in that there are reminders. In the sections that led up to this, both the initial arrival of the covenant, its agreement back in chapter 24, the foundation of many of their feasts that go both before that, and the specifics that come after that, chapter 25 through, all the way through maybe chapter 31, 32, the Lord in this section reminds them of those responsibilities. Things like the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Ingathering, they all had particular requirements. It's interesting to note, at least from my perspective, of the things that God includes in this renewal conversation. On the one hand, they're renewing to everything. Their initial statement, all the way back when they first agreed to it, was, whatever you say, we'll do. That's the shortened version of it. We will do all that you have commanded. Their practice wasn't that. When God renews it, though, He gives them what we might call a synopsis. He doesn't go down in the record of it with every single detail again. It's not like He copied and pasted off the document before and said it again. But there are repetitions. And a lot of these repetitions become the structure of their day-to-day worship and their day-to-day life. It should have been in place. They weren't always in the place, but they should have been in place. And so these feasts would have created a calendar-like structure for them. Three times a year that all the males were to appear before the Lord at the temple. You think about it, I don't know if I can... Maybe I can... use this map real quick. Let me see if I can. Yeah, I can get it over there. Hold on. All right. This is not the exact map of Israel down the road, but I didn't plan to pull this out, but I've got this one. And it's not even the full sense of Israel. Let me go on the other side so I can see everything too. So what we have here is just a quick... Brief reminder of some things. You'll notice down in the right-hand corner, there's Jerusalem. That's where eventually the Temple Mount section will be found, where you're going to see them building the temple, structuralizing their worship, structuralizing all of these things. We're not there yet, but this region up there, and really a large chunk of this whole area that goes down to, I'll use my hand to extend the map, to about there-ish. That's where Israel would be. Three times a year, all the males have to journey to the temple in order to keep the standards of God's expectation. Have you ever wondered how long it takes to get from one spot to another? When's the last time you walked 10 miles in one day? I know the answer from me, because I just happened to be looking at my list of last time I went camping and backpacking. That's a long way, all right? I mean, you can hike around a lot of places for 6-7 miles a day in an amusement park. If you go to an amusement park, you're probably going to put in 6-7 miles. 10 miles, okay? That's actually the not even a beginning of some of these distances. If you're going from Shiloh to Gibeon, you know, that's a little bit more than 20 miles, I think, if I'm remembering the distance right. So you have people that are traveling maybe 100 miles before trains, planes, and automobiles, 3 times a year for worship, in addition to everything else they were doing, and the other feasts and the other gatherings. You think about the structure of their lives as designed. A large part of their community is built upon going to worship together as the people of God. That's the intended one. In reality, did they do that every year like they were supposed to? Sometimes. Sometimes they get it, sometimes they wouldn't. You think about our lives. How much of our life revolves around worship? Well, you're here, right? This is by choice to a certain degree. We've set aside this time for our benefit every first day of the week. Does it feel burdensome sometimes? How you answer that question depends on how your faith is going. If your faith is weak, then you'd be like, not as easy as it used to be. As your faith soars and grows, and then you add habit to that faith, it's like, oh, that's what we do. It becomes part of whom you are. And if you don't do it, you feel weird. Okay, so as much as it seems foreign for them to travel so far to worship, it's not really that much of a difference for us. We have some conveniences. Us to travel 100 miles, trains, planes, and automobiles make that pretty easy, right? 100 miles, no big deal. But we do it on an all-the-time basis. They had a different worship schedule. They were worshiping as family units, especially over the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and they had the Passover and different things that would come up. And so you had settings in which they had worship like we do. But they also had, think about it this way, go into the gospel meeting. Culturally, and I know for some of you this is definitely true, when the gospel meeting season took place, your whole life shut down, right? Because you're going to meetings. And you went every night, and it wasn't necessarily the congregations where you were at. Tent meetings, whatever. There's not a huge difference in that structure sign. And I'll tell you, it's something that's powerful for us to see. We make that same kind of commitment to God, and He reminds us at times with those synopses in the New Testament, where He doesn't recover everything. He goes, this is important, remember this thing. And this is important, remember that thing. He doesn't just review the entire sermon of Jesus on the Mount. They just remind you of the general principles. Something that's in another factor in this section, and we're looking at verses 17 through 26 here. All of these aspects that were important were things connected to respect of worship. There's a side section of it that comes up, and that's involving the next section as well, but things involving the Sabbath. It was one of the two major distinctions for the people of Israel. What was the first major distinction for the people of Israel? Well, not first, but one of the ones we know of really easily for the men. Circumcision, right? That makes them different. But their Sabbath practice made them different too. It affects you and I. You ever had anyone tell you, hey, I want you to work on this project on Sunday, and you say, no, can't? You ever have anyone tell you, yeah, I need you to come in, and you go, well, we got a gospel meeting. I just can't. Did they look at you weird? Yeah, you know. They look at me weird, and I preach. Like, oh, they can say, that's your job. Like, well, it is. Well, why can't you get out of this one time? Can't you get a a replacement for you? Like, it's not about my job. If I wasn't preaching, I'd still be here. And I'm here when I don't preach. I mean, it's just not, that's a whole perspective. But that made Israel different. Because the other nations, the other religious structures of the nations around them simply did not do that with that kind of consistency or regularity. And so Israel would be standing out because of that. And those regulations as they're laid out would then continue to hone in on what makes them distinctive. In this case, it's the perspective where we emphasize it. 6 days they will work, and then they rest from their labors on the seventh. We refer to that as the Sabbath in the official sense. Think about how that played out for these folks, the ones who are receiving it. Do you think slaves got rest days under the Egyptian masters they were serving under there? I'll tell you what history tells us, but we don't really have to look at history to figure this one out. They didn't get rest days. They had 7 work days. And that was how their experiences were. When God begins to show them the idea of the Sabbath, He teaches them a process. What do they do in preparation for that seventh day involving the manna? And they had to lay in store, lay by in store, as you might say in a phrase that's familiar to us. Store it up a little bit so that they wouldn't have to work on that day. They're beginning to prepare for it. Now when they have the standard of it, it's actually put in as a statute, an expectation, they're prepared. Now move forward, and this helps us kind of see the importance of it as we're closing out this section. When we come to Israel in the first century, do you have any Bible passages or Bible stories that would bring up some Sabbath ideas of how they would view the Sabbath? Did Jesus ever talk about the Sabbath at all? Did He use that term? Is he a Lord of anything? Did they ever complain about, I don't know, an ox in a ditch? That story come to mind? What would any normal person do if their ox was in a ditch? They'd get him out. But there were some Jews who were acting like getting him out of the ditch on the Sabbath would be what? That'd be working. That'd be bad. That'd be bad. Jesus is one teaching him and saying, hey, wait a minute. Isn't that just weird? Because if no one was looking, you guys would all go get the ox out of the ditch. That's why He would tell them, do what they say, not what they do. That's part of their hypocrisy in that regard. So with Jesus coming in and beginning to teach them about the Sabbath, and I'll tell you one more thing, and the writings of the Jewish scholars of the day confirm this. They found every single possible way to find a way around these regulations. One of the regulations they would encounter would be on how far they could travel from home on the Sabbath. You know what they figured out? A way to make a new home halfway there. If we stop and eat just enough for a meal, we're home. And if we're home, what can we do when we get back on the road again? We can travel some more. And they would just lily pad like a frog down the road on the Sabbath. But no, they were not working. And they certainly weren't journeying far from their homes. Because, like the Pharisees, they had built a hedge around the law so they could go and do whatever they want. Now, sometimes Israel will do that as a whole. In this case, the Pharisees would do this. One quick application. Make sure that you and I don't do that. We can certainly do the same thing. God can tell us plainly something that's really important, necessary for us to do as a Christian. And maybe we're doing the thing that Joe warned us about, that we're forgetting how it might look. Or we might forget what God said, and we build this little hedge around God's will and say, well, that only applies if I was in the first century. Well, that only applies if I'm an elder or a preacher. Because those are really, really visible things. I'm just an average Joe Schmo member. Nobody pays attention to me. I'll tell you, folks probably pay more attention to you than you know. And sometimes they pay more attention to you than they do to the preacher because they know you. And frankly, they don't know me. And so they're paying closer attention to you in those circumstances than any of us. And so being aware of that risk of hedge building around God's will is just a very powerful side point, especially in this case, when the law is instituted, this is really specific and really clear. It's one of those big, bold, don't do it things. One other thing to consider, and this is important, this expands on our idea of God's mercy, is that God is absolutely willing to give these people a second chance. Something to remember about the nature of God, especially as we're closing class right here, God is really in the business of second chances. That's like His job in this context. They had done everything in essence that He had told them not to do when they made that calf and worshipped Him like the nations around them. And yes, He was upset. And yes, He was grieved. And yes, He was hurt. And He brought them back. That's you and me too. We've broken God's heart. We've rebelled against Him. And He will take us back too. And so whenever we're looking at these Old Testament portions like this, I think it's just really important for us to make that connection as well. I think that's it for our class time this evening. So we'll pick up here and close out chapter 34 on Sunday morning and definitely move into chapter 35. Thanks, everybody.